man's got to know his limitations.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All righty then, let's get back to the phones. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Now, a couple things I want to mention before I go back to the caller. I have got some audio, and some of you have been buzzing around. Patrick, look at this audio from a video from Project Veritas, an undercover journalistic group. I'm well aware of that, and I became aware of it when it broke yesterday. And I'm going to share it with you. This is somebody who's rather high up the food chain in Pfizer who does not realize that he's being questioned about what's really going on with some of the vaccines and modification of the virus, etc. And he's kind of spilling the beans on stuff that people are not supposed to know about, people like you anyway. You're not supposed to know about this. And so don't worry. I'm all over this like a hobo on a ham sandwich. I'm all over the news every day, so I appreciate those of you who have breathlessly been sending me emails. Don't worry, I'm on that. And a little bit later in this hour, I'm going to play that audio for you. It'll be a somewhat shorter version of the total, but we'll link to it so you can watch the whole thing for yourself. But that's coming, so stand by. Back to the phones, though. First of all, we're going to go to Therese back to Therese in Winter Haven, Florida. Therese, you just got started and we had to take a break, so why don't we take it from the top?
Okay. I read an article in the National Catholic Register this week that was concerning Pope Francis, and he's once again considering German Bishop Heiner Wilmer for the prefect of the Dicastery of the Doctrine of Faith. Yep. And Bishop Wilmer is one who he embraces and endorses all of the different ideas that are being set forth in the synodal way.
That is correct.
And I just get a really bad feeling about this, because isn't the Dicastery of the Doctrine of Faith, isn't that the department that is in charge of defending the church from heresy?
Yes.
And defending the doctrine? And
yes.
Yet, this is a bishop who's embracing these concepts that don't even reflect our faith.
That is
so
correct.
So I was wondering if you could speak to this, because it almost seems sort of sinister.
Well, all I can tell you is what you already know. This is exactly the case. It's caused a shockwave that his name would even be proposed as the prefect for this dicastery. And I don't personally know him, obviously, but being aware of the terrible mistakes that the hierarchy in Germany have been routinely making in recent years, and their deviation from the gospel, their attempts to subvert the gospel on sexual matters, among others, is breathtaking and mind-boggling. And so the fact that he, of all people, would be mentioned as a possible person to fill, man to fill that role, is just mind-boggling. So I don't know what more to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It defies belief, really, and we'll see what happens. So this is one reason, Therese, yet another reason, that we should all be praying fervently for the Holy Father, pray for God to enlighten his mind and give him courage of conviction, and something we would pray for any pope. He happens to be the pope right now, so we should be really fervently praying for him and asking the Lord to guide his steps and the decisions that he makes, because it seems to me that if, in fact, this man were to be made the prefect of that congregation, it would be a disaster. Now, I have no say in this, nor do you. But I can't pray for what I hope to happen. And I, based on everything I know, I sure hope that this bishop is not named to that post for the reasons I just mentioned.
Okay. I know that the cardinals had been strongly against his appointment. And then a Cardinal Pell was one of the cardinals, and now he's passed away. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that Pope Francis maybe, I mean, you have no way of knowing this, but he just thought, okay, I'm going to try again now that somebody as strongly voiced as Cardinal Pell is no longer in the picture?
I don't know, Teresa. That's speculation, and I'd prefer not to speculate because I have no way of knowing, and I don't want to muddy any already muddied waters with my own speculations. So the best I can tell you is we're living in strange times in the church where very strange things are going on, and for whatever reason, the Lord is permitting this. So the best thing that I can do, and my advice to you, would be just be fervent and prayerful and trust in the Lord that he will bring us through what seems to be some very perilous times. That's really all I can do, because I can't affect any change in that regard. So my role, it seems to me, is to do the best I can to teach the faith, the perennial teachings of Jesus and the gospel and the church and the catechism, and then trust in Jesus and say my prayers and keep moving forward. That's my advice, really.
Well, thank you, Patrick. Thank you for being there. And you're probably the only one I could ask this question of, thank you for being there.
Thank you, Therese. So we're all in this together, and we join in prayer, and especially let's pray for our Holy Father. Thank you. Let's go to Noel, I don't know which, in San Francisco. Good morning, Noel.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
So there's been a lot, not to add salt to the wound now, but with Pope Francis' recent interviews about homosexuality being not a crime, mm-hmm. he now saying that it's no longer a sin. And it's been declared since day one.
I have to apologize. I cannot hear you. There's too much background noise and rustling around. Can you hold the phone up to your mouth more closely? Because I can't really hear you.
Yes. So basically, Pope Francis' recent interview, it's been buzzing in the feeds from Dr. Marshall and mm-hmm. whatnot as far as him declaring homosexuality as not being a crime. Mm-hmm. Does it now say, you see, now declaring that it's no longer a sin when it's been declared a sin since day one in the church?
Well, my reading of that interview was that he said that this is not a crime, and reiterating the view that, you know, that we shouldn't discriminate against gay people or trying to recall. I don't have the text of the comments that were in English. I haven't read the Spanish or Italian original, so I can only go by the English translations I've seen. At the very least, it serves, at the very least, the average person, without being able to follow maybe whatever nuances might be there, is likely to be very confused by this and discombobulated by this. And already there is this great cheer that went up from the from people like James Martin, SJ, who does nothing but, his every waking moment, it seems, is nothing but trying to push for a normalization of homosexual perversion and sodomy and push for the acceptance of this in a very coy sort of way. But he and others have cheered this, and it, for many people, it's understandably very confusing for them, because it seems to suggest, even if that's not necessarily what the Pope intended to suggest, and only the Pope knows for sure, but it gives the impression that he is saying what you're wondering about. We know that all of us as human beings are called to sanctity, and all of us are called to be chaste and pure. And anything in any format, whether it's homosexual, heterosexual, keeping in mind that heterosexual sexual sin, at least, even though it's seriously sinful, at least it is congruent with nature. And sodomy and other homosexual acts are not, that further aggravates the malice of those sexual sins. But regardless of whether you're homosexual or heterosexual, you and I and everybody were called by Jesus to be chaste and to be pure. Even married couples, you know, they're not required to not engage in sexual activity, but they are required to be chaste within the confines of marriage. So this is a universal call to holiness, and anything that would suggest that there's a certain cadre of people, a certain group of people who are not obliged to follow Jesus in this regard is flatly wrong. And anybody who would say that if you are homosexual, that you can act on those homosexual impulses is wrong. It's just as simple as that, really. So I want to acknowledge the fact that over the last 10 years or so, roughly now, many things have been said that are deeply perplexing, and they raise lots of issues, and people get confused, and they think, oh, well, is the church saying now that I don't have to be sexually chaste, I don't have to be pure? And of course, the church is not saying that, but when things like this happens, it creates, when things like this happen, rather, it creates a lot of disorientation, which, to say the least, is extremely unfortunate. So my advice would be twofold in this case. Just repeating what I said to the earlier caller, these are occasions or reminders to us of how important it is to pray for our bishops and to pray for the Holy Father, that God would clarify and give the courage and all the things that are necessary for these bishops and the Pope himself to do the best job they possibly can do. We should never cease praying for these things every single day, many times a day, perhaps. The other thing is to always remember what Jesus taught. Jesus said, if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you have committed adultery. And if you look at a man with lust in your heart, you have committed, maybe not adultery per se, but you've committed a serious sin. And to act on those thoughts goes beyond even how bad it is to entertain those ideas in your mind. So if you know what Jesus said, you know the church's moral teaching, just keep focused on that. And no matter what anybody may say in an interview, you know the truth, and keep your eyes fixed on Jesus. And you'll never go wrong by doing that. That's my advice, and I'm not sure what else I can say on that point, but that's the advice I try to live. Thank you. Let's go to Sally now in Temecula, California, that is. Good morning, Sally. Wine country.
Well, yes, it is. How are you, Patrick? Good morning.
I am well, thank you.
Yeah, I have a question, because my daughter goes to a Catholic school, and they talk about whether it is a parable or a real one, the Adam and Eve, right? And then they asked, my daughter was like, well, if there's the first people, Adam and Eve, how and who were the people like their children married to?
Each other.
Where are those people come from?
They married each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, the simple answer is Adam and Eve's children married each other and produced offspring together. And then once the siblings, there were probably quite a few of them, once they had produced enough children, then it would be cousins intermarrying. And within a not too lengthy period of time, they were no longer closely related. But at first, the siblings married each other.
So when Cain left, right? And then it says in the Bible that like Cain, and then he got married. You know,
yeah, he married a sister.
And then he get married.
He married a sister.
Oh, okay. So they have sisters, not just their boys.
Oh, no. So three of them are mentioned in Scripture, Cain, yes, Abel, yes, and Seth. But the Bible also says that Adam and Eve had many other children. And by many, we're not sure how many, but if I had to guess, I would guess that it's probably, you know, dozens and dozens or scores of children. And then those children married and had children. And then rather quickly, there were enough people that they didn't have to closely intermarry anymore.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So, yeah, thank you for clarifying. I'm going to tell her that. She's okay. at school right now, but thank you so much.
You're welcome. Nice chatting with you. Thank you. Yeah, my parents used to live right on the border of Temecula and Menifee. And so I know that area very well. Let's go to Lucy now in Indiana. Hi, Lucy.
That's right. I just wanted to thank you because in listening to your station a while ago, I heard you give advice to pray the rosary. And I was mm-hmm. going through some things at the time, and it helped me a lot. And so recently I reconnected with a friend through Facebook, and she reached out to me and told me she was having issues. And I told her to pray the rosary. And because of your advice, I told her to pray the rosary. And this morning she sent me a message that said that she prayed it and that it saved her life because she was contemplating suicide.
Oh, my. Wow.
And I wanted to thank you because I would not have been in a position to even suggest something like that if I hadn't found Relevant Radio. And so thank you.
Thank you, first of all, for sharing that with us. Praise God. And thank you, Blessed Mother, for intervening in such a beautiful way. It's just, there's no end to the miracles, is there, Lucy?
No, exactly right. And I appreciate it. There's still more. I'm still listening to you because there's still so much more that I need help with. But that was just one of the beautiful things that came out of listening to your station. So thanks, Patrick. I'll keep listening.
Oh, well, okay, I'll count on that, Lucy. Thank you. Thanks for letting us know. That's beautiful. Yeah, pray the rosary. Pray the rosary. You can't go wrong. If you pray the rosary, you are going to surround yourself with lots of graces from God and lots of intercession from Our Lady. Gee whiz, I wanted to go to another call, young Thomas, but I guess I'm not going to do that yet. I'll be right back with more of your phone calls and that Project Veritas audio that I told you I'd share with you. I know all about that and all the alleged monkey business going on behind the scenes with Pfizer and vaccines. Don't miss this.
How sweet it is to be loved by you.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
How sweet it is to be loved.
I just heard my name called. Real quick, before we get to that Project Veritas audio, I'd like to go to Chris in San Francisco. Good morning, Chris. Welcome.
Hey, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for getting me on so quick. I think it was a weird situation in confession a few months ago. I went there. My little brother passed away about a year and a half ago after a mixed drug intoxication on his first day of living in Phoenix. So I know he got it up here. And my work takes me very frequently into the, I actually probably know the guy you got it from because it was his kindergarten best friend. But you know, I go through the Tenderloin neighborhood a lot in San Francisco, which has, I'm sure you've been up here, is a lot of suffering, a lot of, folks who are, in poverty, but also a lot of folks struggling with substance abuse. And on the corners you have, you know, drug dealers who are very clearly drug dealers, oftentimes connected with, Central American or Latin American cartels. Not that they're the only ones out there, but they're the most prominent and the most violent. And, you know, that's a triggering thing for me going through what I went through. And, you know, sometimes I go, well, the police aren't doing anything. The feds ain't doing anything. The state ain't doing anything. Wouldn't it be great to go see somebody just go Batman on them? So, you know, I know that's not the right mentality. So I go to reconciliation because, you know, that's a lot of hate in your heart. So I go in there, confess all my sins, and the priest starts talking to me about porn addiction. And now I said all my sins, so that's fine, but the thing I really talked about was really this hate in my heart for everything and for these drug dealers who are just like making life a living hell for these folks living in poverty and those who are suffering from substance abuse. And the only advice I got from that and guidance I got from that is They're God's children. Okay, I agree with that. It is wrong, and your porn addiction is the root of your hatred for these drug dealers, and they're not the problem.
Do you have a porn addiction?
I do not. I brought up that I watched porn in confession as part of my confession, but I wouldn't say it was an addiction. It was like a one-off thing.
Okay. So does the priest seem to, let me kind of cut to the chase as I think I understand it. Does the priest seem to himself be kind of fixated on this issue of pornography and he's not really dealing with the other issues that are more pressing for you? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and I've had the same priest multiple times, and even when I don't struggle with that issue and am confessing, you know, anger or other issues, it always goes back to that, even if it's not brought up.
Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be a bit of a red flag. And if you can see, the priest is there to deal with the sins that you accuse yourself of. And if you're not accusing yourself of that sin because it's not something you've had to deal with, it's not normal, it's not appropriate to suddenly veer into that topic when it's not the matter of confession. So that to me suggests that maybe there's some, possibly some fixation on his part that would not be beneficial to you. So without knowing anything more, if you're getting these weird vibes and he keeps coming back to that topic when it's not really pertinent, I would say find a different priest to go to confession to.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. There is a term, I'm sure you're familiar with it, called projection. And sometimes people will project onto others things that they themselves are struggling with. And knowing nothing more than what you told me, my spidey senses are tingling, and I have a feeling that maybe that might be what's going on.
All righty. Well, thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Now, let's get to this audio. This is by Project Veritas. You probably have heard of them in recent years. It is a it's an undercover journalistic enterprise, and they've done all kinds of amazing things, like getting people to open up and talk about stuff that is not intended for public consumption. This is an example of that, and that is now going, what are we at, 2.5 years and counting since COVID really began in earnest, and we've got the drama of the vaccines, and it's not a vaccine, my friend says, whenever the issue comes up. And all of the above. So with all that as the backdrop, and the Dr. Fauci, you do not know what you were talking about stuff, and if you don't get the vaccine, you're going to die, and if you do get the vaccine, you're not going to die, you're not going to get infected, and all the stuff that we heard, much of it turned out not to be true, we now know. Well, Project Veritas has this video that we will post a link to, and I first saw it when it broke yesterday, and it's essentially one of their undercover guys talking to, and you're going to hear who this guy is. He's this guy at Pfizer. My wife and I, when we watched this video yesterday, she turned to me and she says, I'll bet you that guy doesn't have a job at Pfizer anymore, and I bet my wife is right about that. So without any further preamble, this is an undercover conversation. He doesn't know he's being recorded. He doesn't know that the guy that he's talking to works for Project Veritas. And he's basically spilling the beans about stuff that's going on, at least according to him, anyway, within Pfizer having to do with COVID. Take a listen.
Meet Jordan Tristan Walker, a director of research and development strategic operations and mRNA scientific planning at Pfizer. Our undercover journalist asked Walker how Pfizer is handling the fact that their COVID vaccines are ineffective against virus variants. What he said is disturbing. Listen to this.
We're exploring, like, you know how the virus keeps mutating?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things we're exploring is, like, why don't we just mutate it ourselves so we can preemptively develop new vaccines, right? So we have to do that. If we're going to do that, though, there's a risk of, like, as you could imagine, no one wants to be having a pharma company mutating viruses.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We're like, do we want to do this? So that's, like, one of the things
pause for 1 second.
Okay.
Pause for 1 second. Like, Young Thomas, thank you. I want to just tell you what you're listening to. You'll see the video if you go to the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. Young Thomas is going to post it there, courtesy of Project Veritas. But what you're hearing is a busy restaurant. There's a lot of background noise. And this guy who's got this kind of high-pitched, giggly voice, he's the guy from Pfizer. And then the guy with the lower-pitched voice, more kind of even keel, he's the guy asking the questions. He's the undercover journalist. And the giddy, high-pitched voice guy, he doesn't know what's going on here. So he's being really candid. But try to listen, try to filter out the background noise and listen to what this guy is saying about manipulating the COVID virus so that they can anticipate and have new vaccines ready to go that will fight the COVID that they have manipulated to do certain things so that they can sell more vaccines to treat the COVID virus that they have manipulated. That's the essence of what's going on here. So take a listen.
Why don't we just mutate ourselves so we can create develop new vaccines, right? So we have to do that. If we're going to do that, though, there's a risk of, like, as you could imagine, no one wants to be having a pharma company mutating viruses.
Yeah.
So we're like, do we want to do this? So that's, like, one of the things we're considering.
Okay.
Like, the future, like, maybe we can, like, create new versions of the vaccines and things like that.
Okay, so Pfizer ultimately is thinking about mutating COVID?
Well, that is not what we say to the public. No.
That's not what we say to the public. Pfizer's planning to mutate COVID? Well, that's not what we say to the public. Until now, of course. Let's go.
Pfizer ultimately is thinking about mutating COVID?
Well, that is not what we say to the public. No. That's why it was a thought that came up at a meeting, and we were like, why do we not? It was like, we're going to consider that. There'll be more discussions.
Okay.
That exact reaction, right? We're like, wait a minute. Like, people won't like that.
That's right. It appears that Pfizer is internally discussing the possibility of mutating the COVID virus themselves in order to tailor a vaccine to sell to the public. Listen to Walker describe in detail just how they would conduct such a scientific experiment. First, in living animals.
So the way that we're thinking about it, don't tell anyone this. You gotta promise you won't tell anyone.
Okay. You hear what he's saying? He's saying, promise you won't tell anybody. Promise you won't tell anybody. He couldn't make that promise, that's for sure. So they're going to be using monkeys and using these mutated versions of COVID to test out on monkeys so they can figure out what's the next generation of vaccines that we can roll out and make a lot of money on, because we now control the way in which this version of COVID will act. So we can tailor make, using the monkeys, we can tailor make a vaccine that will treat that. Let's continue.
So the way it would work is, like, we put them in the virus in these monkeys.
Okay.
And then we successively, like, cause them to keep infecting each other. And we collect serial samples from them. And then the ones that are more infectious, like the virus, we'll put them in another monkey and just constantly actively mutate it. That's one way.
Okay.
Or you can even do, like, directed, like, simulation, which, like, we should not prefer. And then you just sample what the different, proteins on the surface of the virus look like over time.
Okay.
So then you can see the mutation, and you can kind of force it to mutate in a certain way you want.
Okay.
But you have to be, like, very controlled to make sure that this virus that you mutate doesn't create something that, like, you know, goes everywhere.
Something
which
crazy.
I suspect is the way that the virus started and moved on. To be honest, like, it makes no sense if this virus popped out of nowhere. Like,
yeah, I know.
COVID virus experimentation on live monkeys? This is unethical, to say the least, and Walker describes those experiments as if they are ongoing and not simply a hypothetical discussion.
So, I mean, when is Pfizer going to implement the mutation of all these viruses?
I don't know. It depends on how the experiments work out, because this is just, like, something we're trying, right?
It sounds like gain of function to me.
I don't know. It's a little bit different. I think it's different. It's like, there's... It's definitely not gain of function.
Sounds like it is. I mean, it's okay.
No, directed evolution is very different.
Direct evolution?
Directed evolution.
Directed evolution, okay. Well, so, I mean, is that what it is?
Maybe.
Let's pause it for a second. Here's a definition of gain of function. So gain of function research, one definition is, gain of function research is medical research that genetically alters an organism in a way that may enhance the biological functions of gene products. This may include an altered pathogenesis, transmissibility, or host range. In other words, the types of hosts that a microorganism can infect. That's what they're referring to here in terms of the manipulation for the purposes of gain of function. Do we have much left of this audio, young Thomas?
Yeah, I mean, they go on about this for a bit. There's probably about another 4 minutes left.
Okay. Well, let's listen to another minute or so of it, just so people
This guy sounds so intoxicated. Just listening to his voice, I'm just like, wow, he has no idea what he's saying. He knows what he's saying, but he has no idea the impact of what he's saying. Like, wow. Right.
That's why my lovely wife looked at me when we first listened to this, we watched the audio yesterday, and she said, I'll bet that guy doesn't have a job today.
Right.
So let's listen to another minute or so. And then you're going to post this, right, for everyone to be able to access it?
Yeah, after you get done with this, I'll go and post it on Twitter for everybody.
Let's hear another minute or so.
Sounds good.
Well, you're not supposed to do gain of function research of the viruses, they recommend not. But you do like these like selected directional mutations to try to see if you can make more potent.
Yeah.
So there is research ongoing about that. I don't know how that's gonna work. There might not be any more outbreaks.
So tell me more, like, what's developing with the whole, you know, virus mutation process?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're still kind of conducting the experiments on it, but it seems like from what I've heard, they're kind of optimizing it, but they're going slow because everyone's very cautious. Like, you know,
right.
Obviously, they don't want to kind of accelerate it too much.
Yeah.
But I think they're also just trying to do it as an exploratory thing because you obviously don't want to advertise that you're trying to figure out future mutation.
Right. So, did the whole virus mutation thing, like, come from your executive, Sarah?
No. That came from, like, we have, like, chief scientific officers in, like, the other divisions.
In a subsequent meeting, our undercover journalist asked if this type of gain-of-function research is already being studied at Pfizer. But no, as long as it's called directed evolution, Pfizer's in the clear.
What's the goal for Pfizer of doing that?
So probably what they want to do is, like, to try to figure out, to some extent, try to figure out, like, you know, there's all these new strains of variants that just pop up. Why don't we try to like catch them before they pop up in nature, and we can develop a vaccine prophylactic for like new variants.
Yeah.
So that's why they're thinking like if you do it controlled in the lab, then we say, oh, this is a new epitope, and so then if it comes out later on, like in the public, we already have a vaccine kind of working on it.
That's perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't that the best business model though?
Yeah, let's pause there, and we'll get the rest. We'll get this posted so you can watch it for yourself. It's longer than what you just heard on here, but you get the gist of it. So you heard that last part. In essence, what he's saying is, we're going to manipulate COVID and make it stronger. I mean, we're talking about something that killed a lot of people. Not to mention those who have been harmed by the vaccine. It's not a vaccine, my friend says. Not to mention the people who have been harmed by this, as we now know, looking back on it. And this is not to say the vaccines per se are harmful. I mean, I think we owe a great debt to medical science and the fact that we can live longer and healthier lives as a result of vaccines. That's certainly how I feel. But it certainly looks as though, if what this guy from Pfizer is saying is true, I mean, it certainly looks as though there is manipulation of COVID and making it stronger, or at least contemplating doing this as a way to make a whole lot more money, because then you can tailor make your vaccines and bring them to market and get everybody dosed so that it kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, as opposed to meeting a danger in the wild and finding something that will counteract it. It is, it sounds as though it's going to be manipulated for profit. Or that's how it seems anyway. So I wanted you to know about it. And yes, thank you to the people who were feverishly sending me, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but you were anxiously hoping that I would talk about this. And I do appreciate that as well. Thank you. We're going to take a break. We'll come back to more of your phone calls. If you want to jump in, here's the number, 888-914-9149. We only have 20 minutes left. So now's your chance, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Follow Patrick on Twitter. At Patrick Madrid.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find out more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Okay, we're back. Thanks for listening. And we'll go first to Harold in Queen Creek, Arizona. Hi, Harold.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for sharing the virus thing. It's crazy. I always tell my daughters, this is kind of like the hackers building the virus and then the company selling you the antivirus for your computer.
Kind of like that, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. Hey, quick question. Angels, and I have to hang up. I have to go, keep on working. But quick question. Angels, they always show with eagle, wings. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they say the higher the archery, the more wings they have. And is there anything on the Bible that shows that?
Yes, as a matter of fact. So we see...
Spiritually.
No, it's okay. So first thing to say is that angels are pure spirits, so they don't have bodies, meaning they don't have wings. When they appear to human beings, they do have some form that we can understand, and they do appear to us at times with wings, but they don't actually have wings because they're pure spirits. So it's a form that they take. If you want a biblical example of that, you can see it in Exodus 25, where it talks about the cherubim and these religious statues of the cherubim that the Lord commanded Moses to have fashioned, and they are made with wings stretched out over the mercy seat. So if you're looking for like a biblical description of angels that have wings, you'll see it there. But you'll also see the seraphim as well, cherubim and seraphim, and they're spoken of as having wings. In the case of the seraphim, it seems that they have wings in this version of how we might understand them, covering their eyes. Six wings, we're told. This is in Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah saw a seraphim angel. Each one had six wings. With two, he covered his face. With two, he covered his feet. And with two, he flew. Now, strictly speaking, angels don't need wings to fly because they're pure spirits. But when they appear to human beings, they would take that form. I know you got to get going to work, Harold. I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you. Let's go to Ida now in Sayreville, New Jersey. Good morning, Ida.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. So my question is, just a few weeks ago, we were reading about the Lord's baptism and how John mentions that he did not know Jesus, that he did not know him. And my husband realized that it never stood out that, does this mean, you know, that all these years, these 33 years of Jesus' life, he never saw his cousin besides that time that that Mary showed up and they were both in the womb. So can we assume that during all those years, they never saw each other?
Yes. I think that's the safest explanation for this. And if you consider the geography, have you ever been to the Holy Land, Ida?
I have not.
Okay. If you ever get a chance to go, what I'm about to explain to you will make a lot of sense when I tell you this. So if you get a chance to go to the Holy Land on a pilgrimage, go, because it's well worth your time, and it will help with things like this. So John the Baptist was born in a little town called Ein Kerin, which is just outside of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is up in the mountains in the southern part of Israel. Not the far south, but in the southern part of Israel. It's in Judea. And that's where St. John the Baptist was born. That's where his mother Elizabeth and his father Zechariah lived. Our Lady went to go visit them, but she lived in the north. She lived in Galilee. She lived in Nazareth. And so traveling by donkey, for example, would have taken days and days to get from one place to another. So what we see is that they had this encounter when both the babies were in the womb, and we know that in some sense St. John the Baptist reacted, whether or not, you know, to what extent could we say he recognized Jesus? We could, I guess, but the main thing is he reacted by leaping for joy in the presence of the Lord. So when Our Lady had baby Jesus, she was in St. Joseph, they were in Bethlehem. So they came back they talk about going up to Jerusalem. They came south from Galilee, and they were in Bethlehem, which also is a little town just outside of Jerusalem. And that's where baby Jesus was born. And then, of course, he had to be whisked away to Egypt because Herod was going to slaughter, if possible, Jesus. So they were no longer in that area anymore. And when they returned to Israel, they went back to their homeland up in Galilee. So for all those years, let's say 30 years roughly, Jesus did not live anywhere near St. John the Baptist. And by the time St. John the Baptist was sufficiently old enough, and he went off to live in the desert. We're told in Scripture that he went to Bethany beyond the Jordan. So if you look at a map and look at Jericho, north and a little bit east of Jericho would be where one of the crossings would have been to go into Jordan, the country, now the country of Jordan. So St. John the Baptist was way over there for his public ministry, and he was baptizing and preaching. So he didn't live anywhere near Jesus, and there's nothing in the Scriptures that indicate that Jesus and John the Baptist ever spent any time together. It's possible, but it seems unlikely on the basis of St. John the Baptist sending his disciples to find out, is this the Christ? And then, of course, when he saw Jesus in person, he says, "Behold the Lamb of God. Behold him who takes away the sins of the world." So the reading of Scriptures strongly suggests to us that they never in person saw each other until then. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It's just so interesting because they were cousins, yet all these years they went without knowing of each other. And
well, I'm sure they knew of each other. They knew of each other. Their moms and dads, well, Zechariah was dead by then, but their mom certainly would have talked about, I mean, I'm absolutely certain that St. Elizabeth talked an awful lot about Mary and Jesus. So they knew of each other, but it doesn't seem that they had ever in person met before. I hope that's helpful. Thank you. Let's go now to Novella in Staten Island. Good morning, Novella.
Good morning. My question is about the lectern that's read in the church every Sunday, and there are also readings for the midweek. But Old Testament, New Testament, Gospel, anyway, I would like to know how it originated, how long it's been around, and I know there's year A, B, and C, because I, as an Anglican, we use the same lectern. Okay. And if we read A, B, and C over and over, there are so many parts of the Bible that were left out. This is why people don't know about homosexuality being a sin. They don't know about Romans 1. They don't know about Corinthians. They don't know about Leviticus. And it seems that the Catholic Church and the other sacramental churches, their members were the least knowledgeable of the Bible. I knew nothing about the Bible until after I'd been in the church for 40 years. And I was surprised at how much was in it and how fulfilling it is. So that's my question.
Well, first of all, this is true. There were, and this is puzzling to me, but then again, in a way, it's almost not puzzling. There are some odd omissions in the lectionary. I think that's the word you're looking for, the lectionary, the book that the readings are read from. And it doesn't include some really pointed things that you would expect would be there, and they're not there. Catholic Answers has an article, if you're interested. It's called Readings That Skip Verses Within the Scriptures by Father Hugh Barber. He's a Norbertine priest, and he was a chaplain there at Catholic Answers for a while. That article it's a short article, but it gets into some of the details about why this happened and how to understand, you know, why were we missing some things. Now, I think there are some reasonable reasons that are given for that, but if you ask me, it seems as though there are, for whatever reason, there are some teachings that are omitted because they are so sharp. They're so direct. So, like you mentioned Romans chapter 1, that would be an example of what I'm talking about. So, those are my thoughts, Novella. If you wanted to read further, you could do a little bit of sleuthing like that and get some articles on it.
But could you give me the name again, please, who I should read?
Well, that was at Catholic.com. And okay. You want to look up, you want to look up Hugh Barber, H-U-G-H-B-A-R, I believe it's B-O-U-R, I'd have to check, but he's the priest that wrote that little article touching on that. And I believe they may have other articles on the topic, but it is a real phenomenon, and I myself have never really understood why some of these really important parts of the Gospels are not present, or other readings for that matter. So I'll have to leave it at that, though, just in the interest of time. Thank you. Let's go to Teresa now in Covina, California. Hi, Teresa.
Good morning. God bless you and Relevant Radio and all listeners.
Thank you.
My son has a mother-in-law, and she lived in Monterey Park for years and was part of the senior center. And I'm sure there's a possibility that she knew some of the people that were shot. And she's been living with a lover in a relationship for like 30 years since I've really got to know her. And she is afraid. She went into the hospital, and she was nearly dead. This is like 6-7 months ago, and she was afraid to get last rites. And so I haven't called her. I plan on calling her.
Do me a favor, Teresa, just because we're short on time. I thought maybe you might have a question for me. What is that question?
Yes, I do. What should I say to her? I tell her I pray for her, and she says, thank you. And so what do I say to her about getting her soul in order? Because she's 93 years old, mm-hmm. and I know she's involved with this man, and they're all Catholic, okay? Mm-hmm. So.
Well, what you might say is, I really care about you, and I want you to be happy, and it seems as though the likelihood of your life ending is not too far away. So what can I do to help you get ready to meet God face to face? Can I pray with you? Can I call a priest to come and hear your confession? Because obviously you want to be ready. So I would just ask her the question, in a matter-of-fact way, gently, but let her know that you're there to help. I would try that and see what she says. And it may be that all she's waiting for is somebody to ask her. And what a beautiful thing it would be, Teresa, if you were that conduit for her to be right with God before the time comes. I think that's a great thing, Teresa. Thank you for that, and I hope it works out well. Let's go to Caroline now in Sacramento. Hi, Caroline.
Good morning. I have a question regarding the particular versus the final judgment.
Okay.
I'm assuming that the particular judgment essentially sets your eternal outcome in stone. I don't understand why there would be a necessity for the second one.
Right.
You're not going to learn anything. No one's going to benefit from having your sins exposed. What is the merit?
Yes. Well, there are two different judgments. The first one, as you say, is the particular judgment, and that is mentioned in Hebrews 9:27, is appointed to a man to die once, and then the judgment. So that's your exit interview. At the end of your life, you will be required to give an account of your life to the Lord. And then you will know, as you said, that you're going to go to heaven or hell. And if you're on your way to heaven and you need some cleansing on the way, then you'll go to purgatory on the way there. But in any case, you'll know with certitude where you're going to go, up or down. Now, the reason for the general resurrection, as Jesus talks about in Matthew 25, and it's also discussed in Revelation chapter 20 and 21 and into 22, you see there that God's justice and mercy is made manifest. So the purpose of that, as far as I know at least, is to fulfill, among other things, Jesus saying, what you have done in the darkness will be brought into the light. What you whisper in secret will be shouted from the rooftops. So in the case of those who are the reprobates, who are damned, God's justice will be glorified because the penalty for their sins that they themselves willfully chose will be shown for all to see, and that'll be part of their punishment, that their wickedness will be made known. Now, in the case of the elect, it seems to me to be a pretty strong case to be made from Scripture that they will not be put to shame, and that to whatever extent any of the elect, their sins, if they are made public, and they may not be, it will be to glorify God's mercy and His grace. So the reason for the general resurrection is for everybody to know with certitude who went up and who went down, and for God's glory to be manifested. So that's the essence. I mean, a lot more could be said, but that's the essence of the difference between the two judgments.
But what if you had a high regard for somebody who, it turned out, went down?
Mm-hmm.
That just lessens your appreciation for them and knocks them down.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I would look at it this way. When you realize, oh, that person is not what he seemed to be, or, oh, that person, I thought he was a terrible sinner, but look, he's going to heaven. I misjudged him. So it will, one of the things it will accomplish is that it will verify once and for all those who love God and those who don't. Even if outward appearances were deceiving in this life, we will know. And you'll rejoice in knowing that the sinner who you thought was on a rocket ship to hell actually is going to heaven. That'll be cause for rejoicing in your supernatural charity for that person. But also it'll be a cause for glorifying God that a wicked sinner who hid his sinful life under the guise of, you know, what appeared to be a virtuous life, that he's not going to get away with anything. This is God's justice. It'll be a surprise, I'm sure, but it'll be a cause for rejoicing.
Okay.
Oh, well, lots to think about. Well, thanks, Caroline. Do appreciate that. And I look forward to being with all of you again tomorrow. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. And in the meantime, I will pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.